Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now we're in depth on what Trump would do about ISIS.
In the Cold War, we had an ideological screening test. The time is overdue to develop a new screening test for the threats we face today. I call it extreme vetting. I call it extreme vetting.
That's one of the ways that GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump says he'll combat attempts by ISIS to bring their form of terrorism to American shores. He added, as you heard there, that he would require an ideological test for all immigrants. We're going to talk about what that means. Today, as Mr. Trump receives his first formal briefing from the intelligence community, we're going to both fact-check and analyze Donald Trump's assessment of the threat of terrorism, its causes, its solutions, with two guests who have a lot of experience in this arena. And perhaps you'd give some thought to this, too. Do you agree that terrorism is best confronted with extremely tight vetting of immigrants, of additional American involvement in ISIS territories, and new associations with Russia against ISIS? Is what Trump is advocating a reasonable approach to you? I'd like you to think about those questions in that frame and join our conversation. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR, and our guest today, Paul Piller, is a former intelligence officer for the CIA, currently director of graduate studies at Georgetown's Security Studies Program, and he's with us today from Washington. And Paul, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Carrie. Thank you.
Molly O'Toole is with us. She's a senior reporter at Foreign Policy Magazine, where she's covering national security and the campaign. And she's with us today also from Washington. Molly, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, can I ask you how you assess what this ideological test that Trump is talking about actually means? How do you see that being put into effect?
It is difficult to know exactly what he means. It's worth noting that he didn't specify any countries in particular or really the specifics of what this could consist of. But it does build to some extent off of some of the legislative proposals that we've seen in Congress surrounding the really that were built off the debate over refugees. And there was a suggestion that anywhere that the State Department essentially warned about terrorism, about the risk of terrorism, that those could be countries from which immigration would be temporarily halted. It should be noted, though, that that could include most of Western Europe at this point. So if we were to carry the logic through of what he suggested without really having those details, could essentially, allegedly temporarily, ban immigration from many, many areas, not just in the Middle East, not just in North Africa, but in Western Europe as well. And as for the ideological aspect of it, a lot of people have suggested, legal experts as well, that it would still likely be used to discriminate against people who were attempting to come to the United States, apply for refugee status, who were Muslim.
Yeah, so that's the thing I want to talk about here and try to follow the logic on this, Paul. I mean, when we think about Trump's ideas of immigrants carrying terrorism on behalf of ISIS or other jihad groups into the United States, I mean, as I think about some of the more recent attacks, I think of Boston Marathon, San Bernardino, some of the attacks on military bases. These are people who were here and apparently radicalized here, not being sent here from some kind of jihad group. Have I assessed that correctly or not?
No, you've assessed it correctly. And of course, Mr. Trump has singled out one or two instances where he could honestly say an immigrant was involved. But your basic point, Carrie, that some of the incidents that we have most had to worry about and have experienced in this country have been radicalized here individuals that were involved. This whole immigration issue is really, well, to put it mildly, a blunt instrument to go after the the terrorism question. I mean, just to focus on one thing, to spill out a little bit more of the vagueness, as Molly mentioned, in Trump's formula, this idea of regions in which you know, terrorism has been a problem, or however he worded it. I mean, it's very vague to begin with, and as was mentioned, it could include much of the rest of the world. But it also confuses the issue of, you know, where terrorism has been or from which it allegedly had been exported with the issue of which particular individuals, even if we were to focus on immigrants, would be the ones we'd most likely have to worry about. And if some group like ISIS overseas really wanted to infiltrate a terrorist into the United States, it would far more likely be coming from, you know, someone who had been radicalized in another Western country, as opposed to the Middle East or Muslim majority country, which is what you know, Mr. Trump assumes we're all going to think. So it's not really directed in the right way.
You say that, though, because why? That they would look to somebody in a Western, just easier to get into the United States, or
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, okay. if you were making big plans, you know, back in Raqqa, Syria, to organize a plot to blow up something in New York or Boston or Minneapolis, you're going to look first to people who would be less under suspicion. You're not going to have someone who's coming from Syria or Afghanistan or Iraq. You're going to find someone who speaks perfect English, who comes from Britain or possibly you know, Australia or somewhere else, if you didn't already have someone in mind who was one of those individuals here in the United States and had contacted you and, as you mentioned, was self-radicalized.
Molly, is Donald Trump rightly, though, looking at events in Europe, Belgium, Paris, other places, and saying there is a scenario where we could face the same thing, and one way to stop that is to be more careful about the people that we let in?
Well, there are two ways to answer that question. I mean, and I'll take the second one first, which is being more careful about the people we let in. I mean, right now, the United States has one of the strictest, if not the strictest, refugee vetting process for the entirety of the world. It takes an average of 18 to 24 months to even get that refugee status, and that's clearing all sorts of hurdles before that in the country that they would potentially be applying from. So I'm not sure, he hasn't really given details for how it would necessarily resolve any criticism he might have of the current process, which is extremely, extremely strict to the extent to which Obama's critics, coming from more of the left side, have said that it's redundant. It's too strict. And this is why we have only let in a relative handful of refugees from Syria based on the number that we said we would let in, and also based relative to other countries. And the sort of rhetorical extension of we've seen these terrorist attacks in Western Europe, and thus we have to take these steps. I mean, there are great distinctions that have to be made between the situation in Europe and the situation here. Those countries are accessible by a difficult but possible path from the Middle East, and here is very different. I mean, we're separated by thousands of miles and an ocean. We're effectively an island from this refugee crisis. So the concerns that Western European countries might have about potentially their own citizens traveling to Syria after becoming self-radicalized or inspired online, traveling to Syria, training there, returning to Western Europe, is not an issue that we have in the United States. And that's an important distinction.
Let me take some calls here. And if you've just tuned into the conversation, we are taking apart some of the details that Donald Trump laid out earlier this week in his plan to fight ISIS and terrorism. A lot of that intersects with immigration policies, and so you hear us talking about that first. Molly O'Toole with us from Foreign Policy Magazine, and Paul Pillar with us from Georgetown, formerly of the CIA. And I'm asking you to think about this. Do you agree that some of these ideas that Donald Trump is bringing to the table are best confronted? Extremely tight vetting, as he says, additional American involvement in ISIS territories. He alluded to that. New associations with Russia against ISIS. I'd like you to think about that in that context. 800-242-2 888-651-227-6000 to Ion in Minneapolis. Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
What'd you want to say?
I just wanted to say comments about what Donald Trump has been saying about Minneapolis and the Somali communities that live in Minneapolis. He said one of his speeches in Portland, Maine, recently that there's problems with, you know, Somalis in Minnesota, and that we're hurting the economy, and that we're just, you know, his rhetoric, you know, just like really insulting to our culture and our religion and proof. I just heard you say something about, you know, fact checking for what he says. And if you look at facts for Minnesota, you could see that Minnesota happens to be one of the third best place to live in the country. Number one for business. We bring a lot of businesses to the state and the economy as a result of the businesses that we brought. There were revenue, $1.5 billion surplus we had recently. I mean, if we're so bad and that we're hurting the economy and, you know, Minnesota is having problems, where is these problems?
Yeah.
Where are these problems?
And Paul, I think this is the issue with much of Donald Trump's rhetoric. What I think he might have been alluding to is the very small number of young men who have been radicalized here and gone back into the Middle East to fight with jihadist groups. But there's kind of a broad brush approach when he talks about communities like the Somali community here. What can you say to that?
Yes, and certainly, you know, the numbers of those who are genuine security threats as opposed to the entire community, in this case, the Somali community in Minnesota, they're very, very small. And I can certainly understand and would share the offense that has been taken by members of the community over some of the things that Mr. Trump has said. And the only other comment I'd make is that this goes back to your comment, Kerry, about how this whole emphasis on the immigration as a counterterrorist tool overlooks the question of individuals who are already here in the United States. So Mr. Trump is emphasizing two different things here, depending on what his audience is, whether it's individual Somalis in Minnesota or somebody coming over here from abroad.
All of that said, Paul, I mean, how much confidence do you have in intelligence agencies' ability to be aware of some of these individuals in our community and others that are self-radicalizing and looking to commit some kind of act here or go overseas to fight with these organizations?
Well, to focus on those who might become radicals here, it's always been an extremely difficult job and always will be, no matter who is sitting in the White House. I think the metaphor that FBI Director Comey used is a very, very appropriate one. The task that is faced by the FBI and their colleagues in the security community is not just trying to find a needle in a haystack, but rather trying to determine which pieces of hay will turn into a needle in the future. That's basically the task that the FBI and other agencies face in trying to identify who will be the individuals who will pose a security threat.
To the phones to Ben in Mankato. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
What are you thinking about this?
Whenever Trump talks about extreme vetting, it sounds to me almost like 1950s McCarthyism or the Hollywood blacklist. It seems to be more about political gain than it seems to be actually about a current major threat to the U.S. in general. I mean, it seems basically it's if you disagree with his opinions, then you're automatically a sympathizer for ISIS.
Molly, when you hear Donald Trump say he thinks a commission should be created to, quote, expose the networks in our society that support radicalization, I think you heard Cold War echoes there just as Ben did, didn't you?
Well, we don't even have to make those connections. He made the connections himself.
That's right. He used
in
the phrase,
speech,
didn't he?
He said, we need to have, this is like the Cold War. We need to have an ideological test like we had during the Cold War. So he was directly referencing, very explicit and direct references to that kind of McCarthyist idea that you would think that observers look back on and say this is a pretty ugly chapter in American history, in which, you know, politicians preyed on a climate of fear and anxiety to go after people who may have had a different opinion than them or not at all, just for political gain and preying on that anxiety. So it's pretty incredible that he made that connection himself.
Molly, if I took out the Cold War element of that and we just took this phrase that I read in his script, expose the networks in our society that support radicalization, is that alarming in and of itself? Isn't that what a lot of intelligence agencies are trying to do?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting observation. I mean, there are intelligence agencies that are working to uncover these networks. I mean, one of the interesting things that intelligence agencies have discovered, I mean, when they were initially looking into some of these networks of, in a lot of cases, you know, young men who felt that they didn't have opportunities and were sort of turning towards online, at least, were sort of participating in some of these forums or, you know, expressing certain sympathies towards certain extremist groups. A lot of the intelligence agencies thought that they were going to find a network, that they were going to find a particular recruiter, for example, a sort of shadowy man who was the linchpin of this, the connection to ISIS networks abroad. And in the end, what they found is that that man didn't necessarily exist. In a lot of ways, it was just social fabric that's sort of inherent to the way communities operate and the way young people interact. So that's also very difficult, as we've talked about here. It's very difficult to do, especially when there's so much sort of independent self-radicalization and, right, and socialization involved.
Paul, what would you speak to that?
Well, I think the whole idea of some master network of Islamic extremists is a kind of McCarthy era type image that detracts us from the reality very much. I mean, I would point out that even if you were focused on immigrants, like the San Bernardino shootings, which I think was one of the things that Trump mentioned in his speech, you know, there was no organizational connection whatsoever, you know, to ISIS, even though one of the shooters, you know, invoked the name of ISIS with a tweet or you know, with some sort of message on the day of the shooting. And there was indications that he had actually tried to feel out some other groups like Al-Shabaab and some others. So it's not some big master conspiracy. And I would point out there was a very informative article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago based on interrogations, especially of one German who had been wrapped up in ISIS. And the thrust of the article was to point to the fact that ISIS, the group headquartered in Raqqa, Syria, does have a kind of shall we say, external terrorist support division or whatever they call it. Mm-hmm. However, one of the noteworthy things about it was that the people running this, when it came to the United States, said, well, we're not going to try to extend any kind of organizational ties there because, number one, it's harder to get into the United States. We've already mentioned that. Uh-huh. And number two, they've already – anyone who's you know, radical enough to do our kinds of things – has access to plenty of guns in the United States as it is, so they don't need any physical support from us. So it specifically went against the whole idea of a foreign-run network, you know, extending its tentacles into the United States. That's not really the threat we need to worry about.
Call here from Travis in Tyler, Minnesota. Hey, Travis. Hi.
Hey.
What'd you want to say?
I just wanted to say that I think Trump's idea is a great idea. I think to have uncontrolled immigration by these refugees and an uncontrolled southern border is definitely not in the best interest of national security.
Yeah, Travis, you know that the borders are controlled and you know that the entry process is controlled. I just want to make sure we're using the right language there.
Ma'am, I've been to the southern border. My cousin works for the Border Patrol. The southern border is not secure at all. Back to my point. I don't understand why fellow Americans just think this is a bad idea. To me, it's common sense.
Paul, would you speak to that?
Well, as we've already talked about, as far as immigration is concerned, it is highly controlled. And if we're talking about people, you know, sneaking across the border from the south, here we're discussing things like walls. This is a far, far removed thing from the terrorist threat. If you were one of these mythical foreign terrorist networks that wanted to sneak somebody in the United States, you're not likely to get somebody to wade across the Rio Grande. I mean, there's simply zero evidence that that sort of thing has happened, and it's not the not the way you would do it based on past experience. But I think the main overall point is to ask, you know, how much is different from what we're doing right now? Mm. Is not only the heavily controlled immigration process, which Molly talked about and which you referred to as well, but many of the other things that Mr. Trump mentioned in his speech, one has to ask, well, what exactly is different? And he talked about cooperating with other states, even Russia. Well, that's what the Obama administration is doing now. Mm-hmm. The Russian defense minister just said the other day we're close to having some kind of new agreement to sort out the military strikes against ISIS and the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. Using financial controls and cyber methods, we're using all those things now. So the question is, what exactly is different?
Yeah, one of the things, Molly, that Donald Trump has been saying, which is pretty inflammatory language, I guess I want to try to get beneath the inflammatory nature of it and see if there is any kind of truth to this at all. So listen to what he says about President Obama and Hillary Clinton being co-founders of ISIS.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS, okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Now, when I've tried to figure out where this comes from, he says in other speeches that because of the decisions that President Obama made in Syria and Iraq, it led to the rise of ISIS. There's not a lot of detail around that, but that's what I can draw from why he believes this. Maybe you have a different view.
Right. So he said that, and then he doubled down on it and said, no, that's exactly what I meant. Obama
right.
and Clinton are the founders of ISIS. You know, take me at my word. And then, you know, multiple days later, repeating a pattern that we've seen, said, oh, well, you know, I wasn't speaking literally, even though he had just said days before, no, I was speaking literally, you know, take me at my word. Obviously, Obama and Clinton did not found ISIS. ISIS did not exist. ISIS came to being in the wake of the invasion, the U.S. invasion of Iraq. So this is years before President Obama took office, was even a senator, and years before Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. So that's one of these things that Donald Trump will say that sort of on its face is patently false, easily disproved. Now, what he was getting at, even if he used sort of blunt language, is a common Republican talking point, a common Republican argument. And they've been building this argument for quite a long time. And what it gets to is sort of this relitigation of who lost Iraq. The Republican argument goes that Obama lost Iraq because he withdrew American forces in 2011. Now, we know that that timeline for withdrawal was put in place by President Bush, the Bush administration, the Republican administration that preceded President Obama, when they couldn't get a security agreement with the Iraqi government. But the Republican argument goes that Obama withdrew, he lost Iraq, and in the instability that ensued from that American withdrawal, that's how ISIS was able to gain a stronghold there. And then his reticence to get involved in Syria, or his lack of vision, or his quote-unquote leading from behind also allowed Syria to collapse, which allowed them to establish their de facto caliphate in Syria. Now, that's the Republican argument for how Obama lost Iraq. Obviously, the Democrats and President Obama tend to have a very different opinion on that matter. But it's important to note that there's a political strategy to that as well.
Right.
Because then you can tie, if you talk about Obama's foreign policy and how it, in their opinion, created this chaos that has been filled by terrorist groups, then you can tie it to Hillary Clinton. And they've been building this argument really ahead of her running for president again, knowing that she would be. in order to sort of tie her to the foreign policy challenges that the Obama administration has seen in the second Obama administration in particular.
And Paul, I want to turn to you and say, again, as Molly and I are trying to push aside the inflammatory language, this argument of the Republican House members and the Republican caucus, is there some legitimacy to it, I guess I'd ask?
Not in my judgment. We have to bear in mind that the group we now know as ISIS, as Molly mentioned, began as a direct result of the disorder in Iraq after the invasion in 2003. It's had its ups and downs, but it's had a continuous existence ever since then. The big boost it got was not from anything the United States did, but from the outbreak of the Syrian civil war some 5 years ago, which it exploited to its advantage. The other thing I would say with regard to this sort of argument is the biggest military strength we had, the United States had in Iraq, came in 2007 amidst the so-called surge in which U.S. troop strength got up to 166,000 troops. 166,000 was not enough either to bring lasting security to Iraq, although obviously with that many troops around, it quelled for a time the violence associated with the civil war. It did not destroy ISIS, and it did not achieve its main purpose of getting the Iraqi political factions to resolve their differences and bring some political stability to that country. So if we couldn't do it with that big a force, it's hard to believe that if Mr. Obama had somehow, despite the agreement negotiated by the previous administration, found a way to keep the kinds of numbers that people have talked about, 15, 20, 25,000 troops there, it's hard to see how that would have made any greater difference. And if I could just make one other comment, Carrie, about the Trump rhetoric about who created ISIS. This is a dangerous sort of rhetoric to use. It plays right to the tendency toward conspiracy theorizing in the Middle East. And in fact, just to show one example, Hassan Nasrallah, who was the head of Lebanese Hezbollah, specifically referenced Trump's remarks and said, well, there must be something to it. He's the candidate of one of the major U.S. political parties. He's obviously got information. So it must be true that the U.S. administration created ISIS.
So the way this is seen, and I know there's been a lot of discussion about this, but the way that this is seen in other countries is there's a reason that he says these things, and there's a reason that Americans believe it.
Oh, yes. And as I say, the region we're talking about, the Middle East, is highly prone to conspiracy theories in the first place. And there are still many people in the street in Middle Eastern cities who believe that the CIA was behind 9/11 and believe that the Obama administration did, in fact, create ISIS. As ridiculous and as absurd as some of these things are, it gets believed. And here, when you have a candidate of a major political party saying essentially the same thing, it confirms the far-out conspiracy theories.
Paul Pillar with us this morning. If you've just gotten in on the conversation and you hear us developing some of the themes and ideas around Donald Trump's speech earlier this week about containing ISIS, he's formerly of the CIA, currently with Georgetown. Molly O'Toole with us, a senior reporter at Foreign Policy Magazine, and to the phones to Riley in Minneapolis. Hey, Riley, hi.
Hi.
Yeah. Tell me what you wanted to say.
Well, I just wanted to touch on something I heard earlier about the homegrown terrorism and self-radicalization in our community. And as I followed the conversation over the last few months, the themes I've picked up on are that some of the motivations for self-radicalization come from people feeling rejected from our community or feeling like they don't have a place, and then they seek out a sense of community, and they end up finding that with ISIS. And so I think a solution, just from on-the-ground everyday behavior, is to make those people feel welcome in our community and that they have a place here.
I appreciate the call, Riley, and the insight there. To Kevin in Minneapolis. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there.
How are you thinking about this?
I thought I'd give you a quick and dirty version of how you might implement something of what Trump is talking about.
Okay.
So on vetting, for instance, only let in Syrian Christians and other Christians from the Middle East, because we can pretty easily identify who they are, and create safe zones for Muslims, which is pretty much what the country of Jordan is. And to extend that to immigration in general, use E-Verify for all jobs. Two easy ways that you could address what he's talking about. That would seem pretty sensible, I think, to most Americans.
At the moment, E-Verify is supposed to be accessible, and business owners are supposed to check it, but they don't use it when they don't want to. Let me ask.
Require it for all jobs, all the way down.
I think it is required, but let me put the first part of the ideological test, Molly. This sounds like detail around what Donald Trump meant when he said that, doesn't it?
Right. And in suggesting, there are a few things about that suggestion. One is assuming that all Muslims are terrorists or soon to be terrorists, which is absolutely not the case. So suggesting that and this is something that people have pointed out, many Muslims are the ones who are being targeted. They're suffering the most from terrorism, from ISIS in Syria and Iraq. So they have they are the refugees. They meet the literal definition of it. So to suggest that you can't let in any Muslims and they have to stay, but every other religion can come, is to assume that all Muslims are terrorists and defeats the exact purpose of refugee law in the first place. And Donald Trump's suggestion that we should halt terrorism from countries, particularly in the Middle East, that are susceptible to terrorism or that are suffering from conflict at the moment, would actually go directly against what the caller just suggested. It would ban, which is why it's such a blunt instrument, this built upon version of his initial Muslim ban. It would keep out Christians. It would keep out Jews. It would keep out all religions, even if you were to make the assumption, which would be incorrect, that all Muslims are somehow terrorists.
Paul, I feel like we should, maybe this is a moment to say, yes, there are some Christians in some countries that are being targeted for their beliefs, but let's not miss precisely what Molly is saying. There are many Muslims who are also being targeted by these jihadist groups. I'm not sure a lot of Americans understand that very well.
Well, of course that's true, and we can look at the history of anti-U.S. terrorism. We had our embassies attacked in Africa, for example, in 1998 in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. Most of the casualties were Kenyan Muslims, as opposed to either Americans or Christians or anyone else. But just a couple of other comments about this. You know, to apply a religious test to immigration to the United States is not only so directly contrary to our values as enshrined in the Constitution, which prohibits an established religion, but also would play right into the propaganda and the belief structure of a group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, which tries to portray what's going on as a great religiously based civilizational struggle in which the United States is the head of a Judeo-Christian West, and their group, the Caliphate, ISIS, is protecting Muslims against this religious warfare. That's exactly not the kind of image that we want to portray. And there is no particular relationship between religion and terrorism. Back in the 1970s, when the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine was blowing up aircraft from Western Airlines, they were led by George Habash, who happens to be a Christian.
On Twitter here, Taylor says, bees have killed more people than domestic terrorism in the last 10 years. How are so many people fearful and swayed by Trump's anti-ethnic rhetoric? Molly, think about that for a minute while we get a look at the latest news. But I think that's I know Taylor's being a little sarcastic there, but I think the last part of that question is an important one. So we'll come back to that. Molly O'Toole with us from Foreign Policy Magazine. Paul Pillar with us from Georgetown as we take a look in detail, fact-checking and analyzing some of what Donald Trump said in a speech in which he lays out a plan to contain ISIS. More of your calls and questions on the other side of news and letters at the end of the hour. But now to Phil Picardi. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Donald Trump gets his first intelligence briefing today. One of Trump's advisors, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, is accompanying Trump to the briefing. Democrats have expressed concerns about Trump receiving sensitive information, but Trump says his opponent, Hillary Clinton, is the one who cannot keep anything private. German police have arrested a man who they say is believed to have stored explosives at his apartment. The man is suspected of planning an attack. Police tell a news agency the suspect is a 27-year-old German who might have contacts to Islamic extremism. Federal arson and explosive specialists are searching the rubble of the businesses that were destroyed or damaged by violence over the weekend in a Milwaukee neighborhood. They are looking for evidence that could lead them to the people who caused the destruction in the Sherman Park neighborhood on Milwaukee's north side. 8 businesses were destroyed or damaged by fire, including a BP gas station, an auto parts store, and a bank. The violence followed the fatal shooting of a black man by a black police officer. The hot, dry, and windy weather that's making the job even more difficult for Southern California firefighters is not expected to ease until late tomorrow at the earliest. They are doing battle against a 28-square-mile wildfire about 60 miles east of Los Angeles that spread with astonishing speed yesterday. It forced tens of thousands to flee their homes. An unknown number of homes have been destroyed by that fire. And more than 500 passengers on a cruise-slash-ferry ship are being evacuated a mile off of the coast of Puerto Rico. Fire is spreading from the ship's engine room. No injuries have been reported. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:42.
Later on All Things Considered, Representative Eric Paulson and DFL State Senator Terry Bonoff debate for the first time this year in the race for Minnesota's 3rd Congressional District. Highlights of that debate and all the day's news, I'm Tom Cran. Join me starting at 3.
I know you can't always listen in depth, in real time. Hey, these are conversations that go on for 45 minutes. You can find it on the podcast, though. Right now on the podcast, Rigged Election, what Donald Trump means when he talks about that. Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton's economic plans, and a really great show with lots of good input from you on reluctant readers. We've got a list of books that will lure any reluctant reader to books, and it's on the thread.
Support comes from St. Jude Medical Foundation, the philanthropic arm of St. Jude Medical, a global medical device company headquartered in St. Paul, changing lives worldwide through grants and volunteerism for education, patient support, and healthy communities. SJM.com.
I think what we need to do is convince people who live in the lands they live in to build the nations. Maybe I'm missing something here. I mean, we're going to have kind of a nation-building corps from America? Absolutely not. Our military is meant to fight and win war.
You probably recognize that voice. Then-candidate George W. Bush in 2000 during a presidential debate talking about nation-building. And, Paul, this is something that Donald Trump brings up every now and then on the campaign trail as well, is that we should be very leery about nation-building. He's critical of Bush's nation-building. What happens between the time that a would-be president is a candidate and becomes president on their thinking on nation building? Do you know what I'm asking?
Well, things happen. And, of course, with regard to Mr. Bush, the big thing that happened was 9/11, which came about 8 months into his presidency. And then he declared himself a war president. And that brought us Afghanistan. It brought us Iraq. And we had huge nation-building exercises. If we hadn't had that terrorist attack, which so greatly changed the political mood in this country and provided the political basis, especially for the Iraq expedition, even though it had nothing to do with 9/11, then the George W. Bush presidency would have been much, much different. But I think, you know, Mr. Trump is... he's found a genuine chord here to pluck, and it's one of the reasons why even thoughtful people, even ones that you would describe more on the center or center-left part of the political spectrum here, who would describe themselves as foreign policy realists and who have been very skeptical of the value of nation-building and believe the United States has been overcommitted. That is why some of those people see hopeful signs in some of Donald Trump's rhetoric. Now, one immediately has to add, and this gets to your question as to whether the rhetoric matches the performance.
Right.
There's been so much inconsistency and so much vagueness and so much back and forth with this particular candidate that it would be hard to predict with any kind of assurance at all what the actual performance would be. But anyway, he rhetorically during the campaign, he has struck this note that has resonance going beyond, you know, the kind of core Trump supporter, the people you see at his rallies, but also with a more thoughtful segment of the population.
Francia Nowatana says, I'm profoundly shocked by the caller who said that we should have Muslim safe zones. I'm shocked that This is a serious option. Why don't we just create ghettos and round them up on trains? Muslims are welcome here. And to the phones to Zara in Maplewood. Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Of course. What did you want to say?
Yeah, I just want to kind of respond to the caller who said that we should just let Christians in, and kind of the, you know, the, I don't want to say anti-Muslim undertone, but frankly, anti-Muslim undertone that, you know, me as a Muslim, I feel walking down the street, it particularly bothers me because my family are the ones fighting ISIS. And that's not unique. That's not unique at all. It's mostly Muslims fighting ISIS, and it's mostly Muslims who are the victims of ISIS. I think I heard 90% of victims of ISIS or you know, radical Islamic terrorism are Muslims. And the same goes for people fighting them. So saying, oh, we should just, you know, it's a Muslim problem. It's Islam that's the problem. It's not. It's not. And many people fight ISIS and fight these terrorist groups because of their religion, because they want to defend, you know, the true name of their religion, because they don't want this kind of evil pollution, you know, giving not just Muslims a bad name, but killing anyone, hurting anyone.
Zara, I'm really glad you were listening this morning, and you had a minute with the baby to call in. Really good to have the call. Molly, I think this goes to what Taylor asked at the end of that tweet, which is how are so many people fearful and swayed by this anti-ethnic rhetoric? Do you have some insight on that?
Right. And to just what the caller said, I think this is a way in which Paul had referenced earlier. This is a way in which analysts are suggesting, observers are suggesting, and Vice President Joe Biden in his sort of pre-buttal of Donald Trump on Monday was suggesting that even his rhetoric even now is dangerous. And that's for two reasons. If we're talking about self-radicalization at home, which is what ISIS is encouraging people to do, because then they don't have to try and get people through the very, very difficult processes to get into the United States. If they can self-radicalize at home, great. And what interestingly, a lot of people point to the Somali community in Minneapolis as an example of how this should be done.
Exactly.
In involving working with the Muslim community, working with immigrant communities in order to send this message that they are welcome, that they are a part of the United States, that they are proud American citizens, in order to prevent the kind of recruitment we've seen or the lure of that self-radicalization from having any potency with people who might be vulnerable to that idea. So that's at home. But what's important to note is that abroad, these are the countries that we need to fight ISIS. These are the countries that we are working with as part of the anti-ISIS coalition. And the Obama administration is really urging Gulf allies in particular to do even more, because the recognition is that if it's seen as the U.S. sort of going in, then it's contributing to this narrative that ISIS wants to propagate, which is the battle of the West against Islam. And that's why what we're seeing and really encouraging the sort of ground forces, so to speak, to be Arab ground forces, to be Muslim ground forces, so that it doesn't contribute to this kind of clash of civilizations idea, which is exactly what they want. And as for at home, these ideas that seem sort of on their face to be discriminatory against Muslims in particular, they're having some potency. Because, well, fear politics has always been potent, whether in the U.S. or elsewhere. And I think we can see the shift even, for example, the Syrian toddler, the photograph of the Syrian toddler drowned on the beach that really shook the world and had people asking, right, why aren't we doing more? But then almost immediately after, around the same time, you had the Paris attacks in you had the attacks in Paris and you had the attacks in San Bernardino. And it was a matter of weeks in which that had suddenly shifted from what can the U.S. do more to let's not let in any Syrian refugees. And I think that's a sort of perfect example of how quickly things can shift when people are afraid. But this gets at a much, much larger question in sort of this post 9/11 era, which look at the trillions that have been spent, the lives that have been lost, and you have to ask yourself, are we any safer? And this gets at this idea of why terrorism is so effective as a tool. It doesn't take much for people to start questioning whether they should change their way of life, which is exactly what people want. But in the end, while you can't have 100% certainty of not having a terrorist attack, 100% certainty that any immigrant that's let into the United States won't commit some sort of crime, you can never reduce that risk totally to zero. But how much you want to spend, how much you want to let that affect your life.
Molly, I really appreciate the insight here. I feel like we benefited from the experience of your reporting. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Molly O'Toole with us from Foreign Policy Magazine. Paul, she brought up something that we're going to talk about in depth in early September as, of course, we approach the 15th anniversary of September 11th, which is whether, I guess, how our attitudes and our thinking about terrorism have changed and whether we have to kind of learn to live more realistically with the threat and the reality of terrorism. And I'd love to hear what you have to say to that.
Sure, we do. And the term that's usually applied to this is resilience. Mm-hmm. We need more of that. We can learn some lessons from abroad, I would say, particularly from the Israelis, who have placed a lot of emphasis on resilience as a way of dealing with, you know, terrorist threats that they have been facing for a long time. And we have lessons to learn from Europeans as well. It's true that there are fewer deaths that we've experienced from terrorism than, you know, whether it's bee stings or bathtub drownings or you name it. But you can talk about traffic deaths, which are many, 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 many times greater than any loss of limb or life from terrorism that we've experienced. Yet it's this idea, this sense that this is that if it's terrorism, it's something we can't control. Whereas, say, traffic deaths, we have a sense when we get behind the wheel of our car that we can control things, even though we are more likely to lose our lives on the highway than at the hands of a terrorist. But it's a psychological thing, not a factual thing. It's something politicians have to deal with. No one is going to be elected to the presidency, I'm not talking just about Donald Trump, but anybody, who will say to the Americans, look, don't worry about this terrorism stuff so much. You know, it's really not that important. No one saying anything that sounded anything like that would ever be elected. You know? And so you see the dilemma here. It really is something along those lines does need to be taught to us, the American public. But politically, it's not going to happen. And so you have to have wise politicians. I would put President Obama in that category, who has said just kind of on the fringes of the topic things that encourage resilience. But he can't come right out and say, look, guys, it's not as bad as bathtub drownings. I think that's a dilemma we're always going to be faced with.
Paul, I really appreciate the insight. Thank you very much.
Sure, my pleasure.
Paul Piller with us, professor at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown and formerly served on the National Intelligence Council and in the CIA.